でお風呂を沸かします。お風呂の栓は来ましたか？自動でお風呂を沸かします。
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI office in Covent Garden. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm sitting here with James Harkin, Anna Tuschinski, and our special guest this week is Cariad Lloyd. Cariad is a comedian, we all know. She's been on QI a load of times. She's in an improvised show called Ostentatious, which is Jane Austen-based improvised comedy with me. And she also is the presenter and host and producer and everything of the podcast Griefcast, which is about grief and about people you've lost, but it's also very uplifting and charming and funny and wonderful. So do give that a listen. Okay, starting with fact number one this week, and that is Cariad Lloyd.
My fact is that Unity Mitford was the only person to be BFFs with Churchill and Hitler.
She was best friends forever, just to for any 80s kids
so,
in the room.
Yeah, she was definitely best buddies, bezies with Hitler. She was very bezies with Hitler. But she was also very old family friends with Churchill. And at some point, just before war broke out, so she was living in Germany, basically completely in Hitler's inner circle. She was completely there. And she used to write to her friend Winston and beg him very regularly to make peace with Hitler because she really believed in both countries. Now, caveat, yes, she was a massive fascist, so obviously not like saying I love her, but she did really believe that England and Germany could work together and become this incredible superpower. And she always said, if they go to war, I'll kill myself because these are my two greatest loves, my country. And spoiler alert, the moment war broke out, she went into a park and she shot herself in the head. But spoiler alert, it didn't work. She survived with the bullet in her head.
Wow. But then she did also die due to an infection.
But much later, much later. So Hitler, her BFF, when she did shoot herself in the head, Hitler felt so bad. Obviously, it was his fault. Hashtag you caused the war. He arranged for a train to take her to Switzerland. And then her mother and I think it was Debo, the younger sister, came and got her. But he, you know, the war's breaking out. Everyone's leaving countries. Hitler made sure that she got out of Germany and he knew she was going back to Britain.
And he funded her healthcare and stuff, didn't he? It's very easy to accidentally read the story and go, oh, that's quite nice.
I know,
of him.
I know. Again, caveat, he was a massive fascist, but also, I think he was quite big into
fascism. He was one of the worst, I would say. You know, there's a theory about Hitler funding all this. So the theory is that her sister, Deborah, and her mother took her home after she tried to kill herself. She then recuperated at a little nursing home in a village called Wiggington in Oxfordshire. The home was a maternity home.
This is rubbish.
There is a story from the woman who ran the home that she may have had a baby. And the baby
had a tiny moustache.
And was a massive fascist.
Yeah, and so the journalist who wrote about this, she asked the woman who she thought the father might be, and she said, well, my mother always said it was Hitler's. Although there is no record of this happening, so it's probable there is not a secret Hitler love child.
Yeah. But they definitely copped off, didn't they?
No, also, that's a...
Really?
Yeah, there's a lot of... Like, it was very suspicious. In the inner circle, all the Germans hated her. They were like, there's this British woman who Hitler literally, she would like advise him and wind him up on stuff. And she was extremely jealous of Eva Braun as well.
And so Eva Braun was very jealous of her though,
yeah,
right?
So Unity definitely was in love with him, but what I've read seems to be like that nothing happened. Basically, he was kind of using her because she was extremely useful. And the other weird thing about Unity is her middle name was Valkyrie. Unity Valkyrie Mitford, and she was born in the town of Swastika.
So weird.
So weird. And so it is said that he was very superstitious. And it was said when he found this stuff out about her, and she was a 6-foot blonde, blue-eyed woman, that he kind of felt like she was very lucky. But apparently they apparently there was no way they ever slept together, but she definitely would have. And she used to kind of hang out with other fascists.
Did she sleep with Churchill?
No, but her sister, Decca, was married to Esmond Romilly, who the big rumour is that he was Churchill's secret son. And it was all sort of hidden that he was
actually
a nephew. But yeah.
I thought Churchill was quite happily married, though. Not like that massive fascist Hitler.
So this town of Swastika is in Ontario.
Yes.
And they wanted to change the name during the war to Winston because of obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And they even did it, I think, or at least they got pretty close. But then everyone who was living there said, no, And so they took down all the new signs and they said, no, we were called Swastika before Hitler came along.
Yeah.
We came up with the idea first. Why should we change our names?
And they were named after the symbol, which was a good luck symbol in, is it Hindi or? Yeah,
Hinduism.
Yeah, Hinduism. So that's, you know, they were there beforehand.
Doesn't Dan have a fact about that guy, I think possibly also in Canada, who was called Adolf Hitler?
Yeah.
And was asked if you're going to change your name. And he said, I'm not going to let one guy ruin the name. And he didn't change his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Mitford,
they were amazing family. Yeah, there literally isn't one of them that wasn't somehow involved in something.
So Unity was, they were all bizarre, but she was bizarre. So she said that her and her sister grew up, her to be a fascist, her sister, one of her sisters, Decker, to be a communist.
Yes.
And she said that they used to scratch, she would scratch a swastika and her sister would scratch a hammer and sickle into the window of the bedroom that they shared together and the scratches were still there. Yeah. And so they really pursued their dreams. Yeah. There was an article in The Guardian about how they're kind of inspiring in a twisted way because she was like, I'm in love with Hitler, I'm going to go track him down. And she did, and she went to Germany and she sat in a cafe that he frequented month after month.
Yeah, she sat there every single day. Until eventually he was like, who's that 6 foot blonde woman that keeps staring at me? And that's how she got to know him. And apparently she wrote to Decker and said, this is my plan, like any good obsessed teenager, this is how I'm going to get him. And her and Decker, Jessica Mitford, shared a room and they had a chalk line down the middle of the room. And at one end was a bust of Lenin and the other end was a picture of Hitler.
Wow.
Because but they were obviously still sisters and loved each other very much. And then completely opposite, but obviously growing up in exactly the same household.
Do you think maybe like sometimes brothers and sisters go against their brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah, well, they sort of, if you read any of the Mitford stuff, there's an amazing biography by Mary S. Lovell, which is the best Mitford S1 to read, which says that they all of them had these incredibly obsessive personalities and filled them with, so either fascism or communism or Pam, who was obsessed with farming.
She's the best one. Pam's the one
everyone forgets. But she introduced a new breed of chicken into this country.
Yeah. So, and Pam apparently was quite a wit, and like Evelyn Waugh was in love with her.
The only people who heard her jokes were the chickens.
Yeah, exactly.
That's sad. Were there six?
So there was
siblings?
And there's a brother who died in the war.
Oh.
And then you have Nancy, who was a very famous writer. Diana, who obviously also being of a fascist, they don't do well on fascists.
Diana was the mistress of Oswald Mosley, head
she
of
was
the British.
She was the eventual wife of Oswald Mosley.
Well, I was just referring to the courting phase.
She was the one who famously said Hitler had beautiful blue eyes.
Oh, yeah. Did she tell Stephen Fry this?
Well, Stephen definitely mentioned it on QI.
Stephen Fry says that she said to him, of course, you never met Hitler, did you?
Yeah. She was an incredible woman, Diana. And she was said to be like the most beautiful woman of her age. Like, men were literally falling over. And then she married a Guinness and had an affair. Not a pint of Guinness. She married the heir to the Guinness. And then had an affair with Oswald Mosley and then ended up marrying him.
And then went to prison. Right?
Went to prison. And she was the only... during the war, they were interred. And she and another woman were allowed their husbands in Holloway Prison. So she was in Holloway Women's Prison. And then Oswald was allowed to join her because Churchill said that was okay. Because he was mates with the family. Oh.
Nancy Mitford was famous for doing the upper class and lower class writings.
Yes, You and Non-You was a famous essay she wrote about
so
the correct ways.
What things show you off as being posh or not posh, right?
Yes.
Have you got a test for us?
I can do one. How do you pronounce word which refers to a large cat with a mane?
Lion?
Lion.
Nope, not posh, not posh.
Oh, no.
Lion?
Oh, you're pretty posh.
I'm putting it on.
It rhymes with barn, apparently.
Lawn.
Yeah. How do you pronounce the game which I like to play where I hit little balls around with a stick in a field?
Golf.
Goo.
Goof.
Golf.
Golf.
No.
Oh, yeah, golf. Maybe you said golf.
Like Darren Golf.
Going to play a game of golf.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There was a study recently that found the Queen has become less posh over the course of her reign. As in, if you listen to her vows from 1953...
Oh, yeah.
She's still quite posh.
Oh, she's still quite
not
posh,
not as
yeah.
posh, though. If you listen to the old recordings, it's almost like... Mm. It sounds almost
but that's her
language.
Accent is less posh. She still lives in a massive castle.
She hasn't kept it real recently,
But she talks quite street, I think, is what we're saying. She lives in a palace, but she talks pretty street.
She says BFF.
Yeah. Wasn't the non-you thing part of it was about that thing where people who want to be posh put on posh words? Mm. So things like serviette instead of napkin. So it wasn't about telling the posh from the working class. It was about telling the posh from the kind of middle class who wanted to be...
The really posh don't say the posh word, yeah, they just call it a napkin.
Yeah.
Whereas the social climber says a serviette.
Exactly.
What if you call it a mouth face wiper?
Like I You're do. Just a plain old weirdo. But yeah, it was just, Nancy was very like acerbic and witty about, so she was sort of taking the piss out of people.
Yeah. There was a lot of piss taking involved, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently a gentleman, when he's drunk, may become amorous or maudlin or vomit in public, but he would never become truculent.
Mm. That's how you know Andy's so common. Regularly truculent.
Fighty, fighty. Yeah. Okay, it's time for fact number two, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that in the 1920s, doctors prescribed intentionally terrifying flights and aeroplanes to cure deafness.
That's Why really did they think that that would... What was their reasoning?
Well,
I would think maybe because it makes your ears pop.
Yeah, but like...
Is it that?
Was not that, no. It was the shock factor. So it actually started with someone who couldn't speak. It was an army serviceman who I think lost the ability to speak during the First World War. And this is in 1921. This doctor called Charles McInerney said it was a psychological problem and that the solution would be going into a plane and being treated to a series of loop-the-loops and nose dives and spins and things that made him think he was going to die. And lo and behold, he took this prescription, he did it, he stepped off the plane and he said, I don't know if I can speak anymore. And it turned out he could because he said that. And then it started being touted as a cure for everything, including deafness. So deaf flights were a thing that was quite commonly prescribed. And Charles Lindbergh, very famous, obviously, aviator, on his business card, he had deaf flights as one of the things that he offered.
Really?
Take deaf people up.
And the idea was that people might have suffered from these things for psychological reasons, you were saying, like shell shocky kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or...
So were they take, was it only if you developed deafness or was it more like, oh, I've been deaf since birth?
There were some people who were deaf since birth. So, for example, in 1930, there was a boxer called Fred Mahan. His nickname was Dummy, which is a cruel nickname because he'd been deaf since the age of 8 months.
Oh, my God.
So he took a flight in 1930. It was designed to cure his hearing. It was designed to cure his hearing with a parachute jump that he was going to take out of the plane, okay, in front of a crowd of thousands. The parachute failed to open.
Oh, my God.
And he died.
Where's the happy ending, Andy?
Yeah. probably in the next fact, I'm afraid.
Oh, my God.
No, and sometimes people did die.
The idea also was that it had to be a surprise, so the patients were told that.
Where are we going?
Don't worry, just put on this rucksack.
They were told they were just going in a flight because it was the altitude that cured the deafness.
Right.
And then they'd go up in the flight and then it would be a horrible shock when you suddenly started nosediving towards the ground or spinning around in circles. Because obviously if you knew it was going to happen, then the cure wasn't going to be as shocked. Effective.
Have you heard about this flight that happened in, when did it happen? In 1969 with Alan Funt. Have you heard this before?
I don't think I've ever heard the word Alan Funt before. I think I'd remember.
He was the host of a prank show in America that was like absolutely massive. Kind of like Candid Camera, sort of
what was it called?
It was called Candid Camera.
I feel like a Funt.
What a Funt.
Alan Funt hosted Candid Camera, which is like the original You've Been Framed. And he was hugely, hugely famous, as much as I would say Jeremy Beadle was in his day. Mm. And he was on a flight with his family and they had a camera crew because they were going to film like this new prank show. And it... got taken hostage. So the plane, a guy stands up and it was at the time apparently there was loads of this happening and they were just constantly in 1969 being taken to Cuba. It was like quite fashionable. So everyone starts panicking. Then some of the passengers see Alan Funt and go, oh, it's a prank. And it wasn't a prank. So Alan Funt standing up, he's like, it's not a prank, which obviously is what Alan Funt would do if it was a prank. So the whole plane starts laughing and relaxing because they think it's a prank. And I think they even got flown to Cuba and they were on the ground for like 5 hours with everyone really relaxed thinking, in a minute. Yeah, it seems like the whole plane thinking, in a minute, the camera's going to come out, we're all going to laugh. And they were winding him up the whole time. And he was with his wife and child. And the daughter has recounted it and said, like, they just thought, he was getting more and more frustrated and upset because no one would believe
him. Hijacker?
No, Alan Funt. Well,
eventually, Funt hijacked the plane himself.
Yeah.
Take me to anywhere apart from Cuba. It did happen a lot. I remember Andy had a fact where there was a guy who said, take me to Cuba, but the flight was already going to Cuba.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's a Book of Heroic Failures classic, that one. Yeah. Charles Lindbergh.
Oh, yeah.
One of his other specialities listed on his business card, which is an amazing business card, by the way, including deaf flights. One of the other things he offered was a plane change in midair.
Yeah.
What?
And this was a trick in early aerial circuses where you would just climb out of the plane you were in or flying and climb into another plane next to you.
That's, would you do that if you're travelling and you'd do it for an exchange, or is it a trick?
It's a trick.
Right.
I was going to say.
It wasn't what changing your flight was in the olden days.
If anyone from Ryanair is listening, they will be considering that. He was a real daredevil in some ways. So, Lindbergh, he did New York to Paris in 1924. I did not know this thing about it. He had to get rid of all non-essential equipment, make the plane as light as possible. So he took out all non-essential equipment, and then he put a big fuel tank on the front of the plane so he could get the, have as much fuel as he needed. Unfortunately, that meant he could not see out in front of him.
No.
I'm not even kidding.
Oh, my God.
To see out of the plane in front of him, he had a few options. He installed a periscope in the cockpit.
Oh, my God.
He also sometimes just had to open the right-hand door to peek out the front.
Oh, my God.
His final option was just to turn the plane sideways for a bit.
That's how I drive. It does work. It does.
Aerial acrobatics was super popular in the 1920s. It was this very specific phase because a lot of people learned to fly in the First World War, and then they realized they could make a living out of it. And barnstorming, it was called, and it became this very popular thing. And I can't tell if it was, I think the etymology of it is vaguely unclear. It's either because people would often do these amazing aerial acrobatics in like fields and people would stand by a barn and watch, but also quite a common trick they'd do is to fly through a barn. So they'd open the doors of a barn and then you had to fly your plane through the barn and come out the other end.
Is that where the trope of bursting into a barn and then you burst out the other end and all the chickens are, you know, flapping around
the
madly?
You know, it happens in every show. It's a sort of Seinfeld runs into a barn.
It happens less in...
But is that obviously where the word barnstormer? It was a real barnstormer.
I think it is from that.
It is.
I've seen videos of them going flying through, and I'm sure that must be where it comes from.
Yeah, it must be. Right? Yeah.
I think they played some stunt games of tennis on planes.
No, yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay.
On the wings.
From one wing to another. There are a few photos of people doing, it's wing walking. You know, normally you're just sort of discreetly strapped to the plane. You're not standing completely free because obviously you'd immediately fall off.
Did that mean you had to hit the ball ahead of where the person was at the time?
Well, how does physics work, Andy?
I think the person who really suffers is the ball boy. There's a guy called Ormer Locklear, who was a 20s stunt pilot. He, I think, was the first person to fly from one plane to another in midair, possibly.
Climb.
He launched a smaller plane out of the window of a jumbo jet.
That's incredible.
So Ormer Locklear was a stunt pilot in the 20s. In a film called The Great Air Robbery, here's one stunt he did. He climbed down from a plane to a speeding car, fought the baddie for a bit, kicked the baddie out of the car, then he grabbed the plane's undercarriage and climbed back into it as the car overturned and crashed.
You should never climb back into someone's undercarriage. Very rude.
Do you know another old cure for deafness around about this time, in the 1920s and before, was to make your own artificial eardrum or have an artificial eardrum inserted? But you could order them, I was going to say online, and they sent you things that were often made of elk's claw or pig's bladder or fish bone or something called gold beater's skin, which I didn't know about, but your dad probably would, Andy, because it's used in the gold leaf making process. Apparently it's animal intestine. But anyway, you put this on a little stick and you put it in your ear and it apparently replaced your eardrum. It didn't work, but it was invented in 1853 or pioneered by a doctor called Joseph Toynbee, who is Polly Toynbee's great-grandfather.
Wow.
Is that right?
Isn't that weird?
That's good. I read the other day, and I haven't looked into this, I just saw the headline, that your eardrum moves the same way as your eyes move. So when your eyes kind of move to the left or right, your eardrums slightly move around.
Whoa. Yeah. Like cat's ears, you know, when they, like, cats are obviously just doing it themselves. Our eardrums are obviously doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I can kind of feel it if you move your eyes around.
I think that might be your ear bones moving in your jaw.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it might be.
All right.
The other thing with, you know, like, well...
No, I can feel it too.
Yeah, it might be your ear bones. You have ear bones too. And it's not just Anna who has
ear bones. Is it ear bones? No, I'm just moving my eyes. There's something moving in there.
Yeah, but I think that's your jaw. I think that's your jaw moving, which is connecting to your ear bones.
But why would my jaw move when I'm just moving my eyes?
Because you're moving the muscles around your eyes to look that way.
Carrie, we're not really into logical fact-based explanations here. So this is kind of a psychological affliction that they thought could be cured by flying. And there was another fashion for curing psychological afflictions in about the 1920s. And this was pioneered by this doctor called Henry Cotton. And I'd never heard of this, but he thought that all madness or depression or anxiety was caused by physical stuff and could all be cured by surgery. And so he used to just pull more and more body parts out of people until they were cured. So he'd start with the teeth. So you'd go in and you'd pull out all of your teeth if you were mad.
And then if you're still, he'd go for another body part.
He'd keep on going. So then
it's like that game Operation.
I bet he invented it. He was like, I could, you know, this is fun.
It was a lot like Operation. He'd go tonsils next and then adenoids, and then he'd remove your colon if you still weren't
remove
cured.
Your colon?
I feel like you need your colon, don't you?
Yes,
I feel
like what about the appendix?
He did acknowledge that
once my stomach's gone, yes, my anxiety is gonna go, because I'm trying to deal with not having a stomach. Yeah. So I'm probably just gonna be really upset. Probably,
you know,
not
little platypuses don't have stomachs.
Don't they?
No, they used to be very anxious. No, they don't.
They used to, this happened to my granny, they used to pull out all your teeth as prevention for tooth decay. When you were like 18 or 21, and this was offered to her, she was extremely poor working class lady, and so they said, well, to save you some money and worrying about your teeth, just take them all out.
Lose them out.
Did you go for it?
Yeah, she had every single tooth removed at 21.
My granny was offered it. Didn't take
wise
them off on the offer.
Wise lady. Yeah.
This guy did pull out his own children's and wife's teeth as soon as he had children and a wife.
He had children and a wife? Or was it, at what point in the ceremony or the reception did he do it?
The christening. There's one in there.
You may now kiss the bride. Well, just one thing before I do that.
You may now ply the bride's mouth open. Okay, it's time for fact number 3, and that is James Harkin.
Okay, my fact this week is that there is a patch of snow in Scotland that fell 11 years ago and has just melted this week.
That is amazing.
It's sad.
It's very sad.
I thought it was amazing. Then when I looked into it, I realised it was sad.
Super sad.
At first I was like, wow. Oh, sad.
Yeah, so there are these people who kind of always looking for the last bit of snow that's on the Scottish mountains. And most years it's still there when it starts snowing again. So it's always going to be there. And actually it always melts from the top. So the bit at the bottom will have been there for the whole time. But this week, and I'm going on a bit of a limb because as we're doing this podcast, I think there might still be a tiny bit there, but it's like a bit the size of a rucksack or something. There's hardly anything, and it looks like it's on its last legs. Probably, we're recording this on September 29th, and I think by the 30th or by the start of October, it'll definitely be gone.
God, but you're in trouble if there's an unexpected blizzard in Scotland over the next week.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hasn't it only disappeared 6 times in the last 300 years or something mad like that?
So... yeah, I read it as in the last 300 years, there have only been 6 times when there's been no snow on the ground in Britain.
God, yeah. You know, like every time you listen to the news at the moment, you feel like it's end of days. And then you read a story like that where you go, and the snow has also gone. And you think, oh, God.
But it's got a name.
Yeah. There's a few of them. I think the one that I'm talking about is called the Sphinx. Yeah. And it's because there's a rock above it that looks a bit like the Sphinx.
Oh, I didn't know
Egypt.
That was the reason. Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think it was?
I thought it was like the patch of snow asked you a riddle when you get there. And if you answer wrong, it folds you into its cold heart. I don't know.
That's how it keeps going. Yeah. It keeps on absorbing.
But like one more virgin to come and ask it a question. Andy, whenever.
Hey! So these people are very interesting guys. They're the snow patch hunters.
Yes.
And so this, we only know about this because of this guy Ian Cameron.
Yeah, and he's like one of the main guys, and he often goes and tries to find these patches, and then we'll take photos of them, and then eventually, pretty much if Ian Cameron says they're not there anymore, they're probably not there anymore.
Yeah.
And he's got a Facebook group which you can go on, and you know, every few days he posts and he's like, oh, there's still a little bit left here, but probably not tomorrow.
But and all of the data he gathers is really useful for climate scientists because he's got a record stretching back years and years now, which is very useful in terms of the temperature on the ground.
And this is what they think, it's climate change. Is that what?
Yeah.
Well, he is quite circumspect about it. He says, look, I'm just going to leave it to the scientists to decide this kind of stuff.
So. I wish more people would take that attitude.
I suppose it seems pretty likely that it's climate change, right?
Well, you know what? I, like Ian, I'm going to leave it to the scientists, but yeah, it clearly is. Yeah. But he told the New Statesman when they spoke to him, he said, It might sound weird to say, but it's like seeing an elderly relative or an old friend. You're slightly disappointed if it's not in as good a condition.
Aww. And you're really disappointed if you turn up and it's not there.
Yeah.
He is all about the snow, isn't he? Yeah, I think he only cares about these snow patches. And he says he...
I'm sure he cares about other things.
His poor wife covering herself in snow. Look at me, Ian, look at me. His children wearing snow hats, eating snow.
Desperately putting carrots out in front of their noses.
Daddy! Are we snow now? No, you're hot. You're hot and you're nothing to me. I'm sorry if it's not like that being Ian's child.
I would like to counter it and say the FT reported he is an enthusiast, but he is not mad. So
tell that to his poor melting wife.
I think Ian Cameron is a bit of a hero because, yeah, you know, yeah, he's like looking at this kind of thing and no one else is, but actually it's, like you say, really good data and...
No, he sounds amazing. It's amazing. And obviously, it needs recording.
People do seem to be taking notice. There's a whole Wikipedia article called Snow Patches in Scotland, which I suspect maybe Ian Cameron wrote this. There are things like... It's so weird. It does seem to be a big thing based on this. So it describes a relatively little-known snow patch, which was Scotland's largest at the time of writing. It said, this patch does not appear in the known literature on the subject, so it may be very under-recorded.
Only the hipsters know about that one. It's really obscure. You probably haven't heard of it. Do you want some good news?
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you want to know about the world's tallest snow woman?
Of course.
Yes. Guys,
it's
I feel
Mrs.
like...
Mrs. Cameron.
So her name is Olympia, and she is 30 feet shorter than the Statue of Liberty. Her arms consist of 27-foot tall evergreens, and she has 16 skis for eyelashes and 2,000 feet of rope hair. She's amazing. And 5 red auto tires for lips, which were painted by the Mahoosuc Kids Association. So basically the whole town got together and made this.
This from the photo, this absolute travesty of a snow person.
I want to know what the carrot is made out of, because presumably that's the size of a bus or something.
The carrot nose is made of muslin, chicken wire and wood frame by the MSAD number 44 elementary school children. It's in Bethlehem, Maine.
If that magically came to life and approached me one night, I would run for the hills.
Andy, why is that? Why would that happen?
Well, like in the snowman, you know, the Christmas thing. I would not go walking in the air with that beast. I would sit indoors with a hairdryer on full blast if it came near me.
I mean, it's not 100% clear, just looking at this from a bit of a distance, that she is a woman.
It's the eyelashes.
They've given it eyelashes in the classic cartoon version of gender.
I think a snow vagina would be a bit much.
You don't see many snow penises on the old snowman, do you?
You don't.
Walking, is it hanging down in Walking in the Air? I didn't notice.
You see a lot of snow penises.
To say.
Have you guys heard about the oldest ever ice?
No.
Is it in Antarctica?
Yes, it is. And it was discovered this year. Mm. It dates back, guys, 2.7 million years.
What?
Yeah.
Is that the one that Putin drank?
I sincerely hope not.
Do you not remember that? He did that. They drilled down to some really old ice and then melted it and Putin drank it.
What, just dropped it in a whiskey or something?
He's going to live forever.
He wasn't down at the bottom of the hole eating the ice when they jumped down to him. As climate scientists keep on drilling down, because the snow that falls and then compacts in Antarctica, obviously, not obviously, but it has tiny bubbles of air, which tell you a huge amount about the climate 2 million years ago. And you can find out how much carbon dioxide there was and what that means for the temperature of the Earth, which is going to be very useful for us over the next century. But this year, in April... there was a freezer in Canada where they had ice cores that dated back thousands and thousands of years. Yeah, you're way ahead of me, Carriad.
No.
There was a freezer malfunction.
No.
Oh, guys.
And they melted.
Guys.
I've had that with ice cream and it is really disappointing.
Yeah.
It is so disappointing.
Well, imagine if there was 22,000 years of history in your ice cream.
Okay, if it's a Queen and Black's chocolate, I'd be as upset as I would be.
And the director of the Canadian Ice Core Archives, a guy called Martin Sharp, and he said, fuck!
This is a bad day for Martin Sharp.
He said, I've had better days. So you're not far off. Yeah. But by a massive stroke of luck, which sounds crazy, but there was a massive stroke of luck, 90% of it was saved.
Wow.
Solely because a camera crew had been filming a documentary about this ice core archive, and they had said, can we move most of it into this other freezer, which has better lighting?
No way.
Oh. So thank God, wow. Most of it was saved.
That's amazing. Is it like ice cream where if it refreezes, it's not quite as good?
It's a bit crystal-y.
That's right, yeah.
And then you still eat it, but you think, oh, I should have eaten this earlier.
Yeah.
It's hard to shove the little bubbles of ancient carbon dioxide back in at the right height.
I love them, though, because they're like time capsules, but from literally millions of years ago. I kind of find the fact that these bubbles are 2.7 million years old more exciting than the ice, because it's like a little world, even though it doesn't have the cool stuff like the Blue Peter badge or whatever inside it. It's still like a little time capsule.
Apparently you're not supposed to make snowmen in Antarctica.
Really?
It's taboo, according to the Telegraph.
Taboo?
They're so uptight in Antarctica.
Apparently, the rules are designed to prevent the Antarctic's animals from being disturbed.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's fair enough.
Animals?
Penguins? I don't know.
They might be like, what the... Is that?
Yeah.
You know... Hey, that's my snow. Imagine if I came into your house and rolled up all your cushions and made a giant cushion man and you woke up.
Yeah, it does sound like I'd wake up, because that sounds like that happened in a dream, I think, the other day.
So that's for the penguins. Is they're like, just mind their own business, and suddenly someone's taken all their house.
Antarctica had no land animals, permanent land animals, apart from that tiny fly.
It's got penguins.
I think it doesn't have.
Yeah, but they live in the sea. The only we did this on QI. The only permanent land animal
is a midge
with no wings.
Hey, and what, the midge doesn't have feelings?
Yeah. It's even worse for the midge, because it could be quite a small snowman, but to them it's going to look like that one from Maine.
The princess.
Okay,
the ice princess.
I now understand.
And the other point, because what about like the Antarctic bases they've built and all the science stations? Like, no one's like, hey, we're disturbing them, are they? Yeah.
No, the penguins are fine with that.
Yeah, they're fine.
That must look like the Death Star to the midges. Okay, it's time for a final fact. That is my fact this week. My fact is that the first person ever to use the word sponge cake was Jane Austen.
Good old Jane.
Good old Jane. Now, we mentioned this because, Carriad, you are in an improvised comedy group called Ostentatious, which is about Jane Austen.
Yeah, I am, AHM.
Great.
Who's in that with me?
Joe Mulpurgo.
Joseph Mulpurgo is in that. Rachel Paris.
He's a great comic, isn't he, Joe Mulpurgo?
He's amazing. Yeah, he does very well. Andy is also in that group with me.
I am. I'm in Austen, yes.
And you guys have got some big shows coming up.
We have. We're going to the West End for 3 dates, the Piccadilly Theatre. We're going December 5th, January 23rd, and special Valentine's Day, February 13th. The day before, that's what all the fashionable couples are doing.
Then on February the 14th, you can do something actually fun, not romantic.
Exactly. At the Piccadilly Theatre at 7:30. Yeah, Ostentatious are playing their biggest dates yet.
And we've both seen it, and it's amazing, isn't it?
It's fantastic, yeah.
So, sponge cake.
So we know our Jane Austen, right, Andy?
We know our Jane Austen. But she coined the word sponge cake, and she's got a few citations in the Oxford English Dictionary, and this is... So it doesn't mean that she invented the sponge cake.
She's the first person just to write it down.
They called it something else before her.
Do they call it cake sponge?
Yeah. The first record of the word comes from her writings.
I'm not even convinced it's a word.
Well, is it two words or is it one word?
She wrote it down hyphenated.
She wrote it down hyphenated in a letter to her sister. She said, "You know how interesting the purchase of a sponge cake is to me." And I think it was the famous Jane Austen sense of humour coming in there. So it's interesting, the first mention of a sponge cake is it being given a sick burn in a letter by Jane Austen.
Which is a shame, because sponge cake is a great thing.
Yeah. But do you know other words that she either coined or first usage... The first evidence of it comes from her.
I went through the OED and found as many as I could.
Did you read the whole thing?
Well,
I've only started at the beginning. Couldn't be true.
Aardvark, no. Yeah. Antibilious.
Ooh.
They're all kind of very Austen-y words, the ones. Like there's coddle, cousinly.
She invented coddle?
She didn't invent them, I suppose, but she's the first example we have of
it. Okay. Don't you have isn't there something you coddle an egg?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. So maybe it's coddle in just that specific term, as in to mollycoddle.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Irrepressible, obtrusiveness, tit uppy.
What's tit uppy?
Tit uppy.
It's the study of tits.
That's titography, Carrie.
Sorry.
Titology. Titography.
I get mixed up.
Photographing.
Oh, I'm getting confused.
Tit uppy, I think it means like a tit up.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
I suppose a tit-up is a mistake or something.
No.
Darcy's always tit-hopping, isn't he?
That ball went really tit-hopping.
Well, that's how Lizzie felt.
And gad, as in to gad about.
You're kidding.
The
verbal use of gad.
Yeah.
That's
I think
cool.
That's better than sponge cake, to be honest.
Yes, it
gad
is.
Gad about.
They're quite niche words.
Yeah that's
they?
What I think as
it's
well.
It's not like Shakespeare, who just invented the and table and all the main words.
Before that, we just literally left a gap.
I've got some mind-blowing news on that, Anna.
Oh, yeah?
So Shakespeare's always said that Shakespeare invented 1,700 words, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm always saying it. And so the words include bump, hurry, road. I mean, it's nonsense. So the reason that he gets all these citations is because the first team of people compiling the Oxford English Dictionary knew his works intimately because they were all lexicographers.
Yeah.
So when they were thinking, oh, well, where's the word critical? You know, they'd say, oh, there is a critical in whatever play it was. And then, now that we've got better technology, we're going back and we're finding way earlier ones. Mm. So we thought that the word puke was a Shakespearean coinage. Turns out it dates back to 1465. It's almost two centuries before Shakespeare wrote it.
I bet Chaucer was saying the word road. Come on. Yeah. Canterbury Tales, it wasn't gone on a road.
Yeah, because it would be weird if Shakespeare's plays were just full of words that no one had heard of.
Well, the audience would be
confusing.
Baffled. Oh, look, imagine the reviews, you know.
But you know, people say now, oh, I find Shakespeare hard to understand. Yeah. Perhaps this was happening in the 16th century. People are like, I don't know what it's on about. I can't really follow
road.
Yeah. There's did you see the amazing website writelikeaustin.com?
No.
So it tells you, you can type in a word and it will tell you how many times she used it. Or is she ever? So she only used the word swoon 4 times.
Wow.
Which for people who watch Ostentatious will know, we use that word quite a lot. She used the word curtsy 6 times. She never used the word marvel. So words that you think of
quite marvel. She hadn't invented superheroes.
No. She was mainly using the word DC.
She did. There were things that I think that she may have invented. Like, so the phrase Tom, Dick or Harry, I think, comes from her. And you can imagine her thinking that up from her own head, right? Or dog tired comes from Jane Austen again. Like, that's the kind of thing maybe she had made
just
up.
Good writing.
Yeah. If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times.
No, she came up with that.
Yeah, that was from her.
That is a biggie. That's probably her, I'd say that's her lasting achievement.
Yeah, but you're only saying that because you've been told that a lot of times by your parents.
That's right.
I think it's above puke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jane Austen wrote not very
well,
according to this professor. This is really interesting.
I'm bristling.
And yeah, according to a lot of people as well.
According to a lot of men throughout the years have written harsh reviews of her.
Well, Virginia Woolf didn't like her much.
Oh, no, that is true.
But Virginia Woolf was a man.
It's extremely interesting you raise Virginia Woolf. So this is a study done by a professor called Catherine Sutherland. And basically what she's saying is Jane Austen didn't write like we think she wrote. That was the work of an editor. So I agree with Carriad and Andy that like her novels are perfection in terms of like the construction of the sentences in the English language. But what this academic says is that was all the editor. And if you look at her works, her first drafts of works, she writes totally differently.
They're just daubings with crayon on the back of a mirror.
Mr. Darcy, big nice man, came in the room, yeah, and he was like, so nice.
Well, she was more experimental. So it actually sounds like she was more interesting. And she said that she wrote a bit more like Virginia Woolf. So for instance, when she had exchanges between characters, like speech exchanges, she wouldn't separate out one speaker from another. So it would all be like blurred in a more stream of consciousness-y kind of way.
Which is keeping the idea of speech, which she's so good at. Her speech is so good.
Yeah. Well, the editor was the one who had to separate it out. And she couldn't spell, so she didn't know which went first out of I and E. She didn't know punctuation.
Well, loads of people didn't spell. Yeah, the rules hadn't been set. You and non-you had not been set then.
Yes, the rules hadn't been set. I think maybe she was a little bit worse than other writers at the time. And also, she didn't separate things into paragraphs very well. So
to be fair, she was a woman in the 19th century or the one before that, the 18th century. She hadn't had a lot of education, had she?
Look, I'm not saying she didn't do very well.
We're really bristling, aren't we?
Yeah. Could it be that she didn't try and write sponge cake, she just misspelled sponge carcass?
What book is that in, James?
You know how interesting the purchase of a sponge cock is to me.
That is a way more interesting letter, to be fair.
Virginia Woolf said that one of the reasons that she was so popular is there are 25 elderly gentlemen living in the neighbourhood of London who resent any slight upon her genius as if it were an insult to the chastity of their aunts.
Wow. Oh,
that's a lovely sentence. Yeah. She's equally brilliant writer, Virginia Woolf.
I know, it's so sad. They're both so fantastic and yet didn't like each other. Well, Austen didn't have many opinions on Virginia Woolf.
There will come in the years after my death a woman who is crap.
And I will call her Virginia Woolf, but spell Woolf wrong.
But didn't Charlotte Bronte hate her as well? There's a quote I'm sure there's a quote from Bronte that said, I read that and I recognise no love that I've ever known.
I can imagine the Brontes not getting along with
it. Yeah, but they're all howling on a moor somewhere. It's a very different vibe.
But wasn't it that when the Brontes came out, they were really popular and Jane Austen went out of favour for a long
time? Completely out of favour. And actually, I think it's partly only due to cinema that she's back in. So silent movies, very bad.
And improvised comedy.
We have affected her sales quite heavily.
Silent movies, I think, would have been terrible for Austen because...
Yeah, it's words.
Because it's all conversation. I think the first adaptation was 1940 of Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, an amazing film, black and white film.
Starring Laurence Olivier as Lizzie Bennet. in his most versatile...
There's been some amazing spin-offs. I don't know if anyone looked into this. Like, I mean, obviously the Austen industry, myself and Andy are employed by, is huge. And there's lots of fan fiction and lots of people writing other books. So I just looked up like the top 20 of other books. There's just like, definitely not Mr. Darcy, Prom and Prejudice, Colonel Brandon's Diary, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Mr. Darcy Takes a Wife, Pride and Prejudice Continues. They read like titles from our show. Wow. Like they're incredible amounts.
I read that a lot of people do this fan fiction because there's not enough sex in the actual
stuff. Yes, a lot of it is sexy. Darcy's passions, Pride and Prejudice retold through his eyes by Regina Jeffers, I think is a little bit more sexy than her stuff because she doesn't really go into it, it has to be said. Darcy and Elizabeth, Nights and Days at Pemberley. These are all available to buy, guys.
More Nights and Days, I reckon.
Hot Nights at Pemberley. Mr. Darcy's Undoing, a Pride and Prejudice variation.
Do you know her sexiest line, maybe? Or the line that most... overtly refers to sex.
No,
it's pretty.
It's with SpongeCocks.
I would like to see SpongeCock SquarePants, the kids' TV show.
Oh my god!
This is just a real classic Jane Austen line. It's in Mansfield Park. Fanny Price is the main character.
Is it Fanny Price? Is the rude name?
It's Fanny. It's Fanny. No, it's a reference to her getting pregnant, and the sentence is just about. It's one of the last sentences. It's about how Fanny Price and her husband come into some money just after they had been married long enough to begin to want an increase of income.
That's not the rudest line in Mansfield Park.
It is an overt reference to sex, though.
Well, would you like an overt reference to something else?
I would.
It's in Mansfield Park as well, and there's a character called Mary Crawford, who's a bad, bad girl. And she's talking about the Admiralty, and she says she used to know a load of admirals, and she says, of rears and vices I saw enough.
Of rears and
vices. Admiral and vice admiral.
Which are both kinds of admiral, but they're also both references to something else.
I don't get it.
So vices as in woodwork.
Yes, okay.
Rears in the back of the room.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and that's an incredibly filthy line.
That is quite raunchy.
The academic community is divided over whether it refers to sodomy or spanking. But it's one of the two.
She's trying to hint that Mary Crawford is a very saucy, not nice lady. And that our main character is in trouble. So that's what she's doing. A good character study,
she,
really.
She could have said that she's known a lot of semen in her time.
And with her bad spelling, she could have made that quite obvious. You can play a Jane Austen role-playing game now, which I really want to play.
Andy's life.
So if you don't want to fork out for ostentatious, you could... No, there's this online role-playing game, and it sounds really fun.
I think I saw that, the video game.
Yeah, and you get to pick a character, and then you have all these interactions. So a Guardian journalist went and played it and started out by making this character who lost her handkerchief and then found it and then went for a walk and bumped into a gentleman. Although the writer did say that while she was going on this virtual walk, she saw a bunch of sheep stacked on top of each other. So some of the algorithms in the game need some ironing out. She said.
Every Austen novel, there's a discreet sheep stack. Yes.
My Lord Willoughby, the sheep are stacked so fine today.
About 10 years ago, an Austen buff and an author sent off some of her manuscripts to various British publishers, seeing if he could get them published. And he made very slight changes to the title and the characters. And the pseudonym he used was Alison Lady, as in A Lady, which is Austin's pseudonym.
It wasn't the world's greatest pseudonym, is it?
No, but, you know, he's the guy who runs the Jane Austen Festival in Bath.
Oh, we know him well.
They all rejected the manuscripts, and only one of them spotted the fact that it was almost identical to Austen's work. He got one letter back from Penguin. He just sent them Pride and Prejudice, and they wrote back saying, "Thank you for your recent letter and chapters from your book, First Impressions. It seems like a really original and interesting read."
I'm going to say I really do like Penguin, though, don't you?
Oh, sure.
Penguin Random House are an excellent publisher.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, amazing.
And
amazing.
Thank God they haven't spotted that our book is just a complete rip-off of Bleak House.
Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you very much indeed for listening. We will be back again next week with another podcast. But until then, you can check us out on Twitter. We are at No Such Thing, and we all have individual Twitter accounts. I'm on at Andrew Hunter M. James.
At James Harkin.
Carriad.
At Lady Carriad.
And Anna.
You can email podcast@qi.com.
Yeah, and if you want to come and see us on tour, we've just announced a whole new bunch of tour dates. We're going all over the UK, and you can see that at qi.com/fish events. You can also see our book. We're publishing a book, which is coming out very soon. You can get that by going to
qi.com/fish.
qi.com/fish, or Google The Book of the Year, which is what it's called. And if you want to see Carriad and me in Ostentatious,
you can go to the ATG website, or you can go to ostentatiousimpro.com/shows, and that has all the booking links for all our London shows and our UK tour as well.
Lovely. Okay, we'll see you next week. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.